Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me
is Mike Cosentino.
And today we have an interview with Sasha Abramski, who's written an extremely well-reviewed new book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Lives.
Still lives,
I guess is correct.
And we're going to ask him about that word.
He lives in Sacramento. He's originally from England, went to Oxford College, and then he went to Columbia School of Journalism, and he's a freelance writer, and I think he teaches a course or something at UC Davis.
Well, he writes for a lot of publications I admire, The Nation and The Atlantic, and Sasha, you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me on.
All right.
I guess my first question, Sasha, is what is the dimension of American poverty? And I suppose it's too complicated a question, but in your book you say there's not one reason for poverty here. There are many reasons. So maybe you could give us a short or long portrait of what poverty is like in America.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that got me so interested in this topic was it seemed to me that a huge part of the American story was just going untold in the last few years. That if you listen to the political classes talking about the way the economy was functioning, in the early part of the century, it was all about boom. It was all about housing prices going up, the stock market going up. It was all about the economy growing and about a thriving middle class. If you listen to politicians after 2008, well, almost all of the hardship in the economy seems to be directed at what's called the struggling middle classes. And left out of both of those stories is the fact that by the government's own measure, about one in six Americans lives below the poverty line. What that means on a daily basis is they're juggling bills. They may be skipping meals. They're relying on assistance like food stamps in order to avoid hunger. They're chronically anxious about where their next paycheck's going to come from. Just basic economic stability measures. And it seemed to me that in not telling their story, we were shortchanging ourselves as a community, because what we were doing was we were painting a series of incomplete portraits. And so if you wanted to understand what America was like in the early 21st century, it seemed to me you had to scratch below the surface, that any journalist worth his or her salt had this obligation to scratch below the surface, to see what was happening underneath, to see what was happening in service sector jobs where wages were going down or where benefits were going down, where people were working but weren't accumulating any savings, where they were working but they didn't have health care, where they were working but even if they spent decades on the job, they'd have no pension at the back end. And so I started rooting around, started interviewing people, started going to all corners of the country, trying to get a handle on what the story of 21st century American poverty was like. And it really is an incredibly complicated story, because you're talking about 50 million Americans. It's one of the largest shared experiences in modern-day America. 50 million Americans live in poverty. 47 million Americans rely on food stamps to avoid hunger. And those are individuals. They're not an abstract entity. They're individuals, and their stories are complicated. And so, you know, when you say, well, what does poverty look like? There's no one single thing that poverty looks like. It could be a suburban resident of Stockton in California whose house went up to $500,000 and then went down to $150,000. It could be somebody living on a skid row. It could be somebody living in the Mississippi Delta. It could be an oyster fisherman in southern Louisiana wiped out by Hurricane Katrina and then the BP oil spill. All of these are people that I've talked to and interviewed in the course of my research. So I think it's an incredibly complicated story, and it's very hard to reduce it to one set of characteristics.
All right, Sasha, I really admired all the parts of the book, and not that it's exactly an uplifting read, but it's certainly an important one. But I want to kind of work in here and see if we can Bill Moyer's got a quote that, except for Romania, more children live in poverty in the United States than any other country in the world. And then he says something about the social contract. He said something to the effect, that sound you hear is the social contract ripping. Now, in the United States, in your view, after all your experience, Do we have a social contract? First of all, what does he mean by a social contract?
Well, a social contract is this idea that we live in a community and that the relationships between government and citizen or government and resident are somewhat reciprocal. So we pay taxes, for example, and that's part of how we give back to community. But in exchange, there are certain things that the government puts in place to stop us, for example, falling into absolute hunger or destitution. So part of the modern social contract is Social Security. So when you get to be in your 60s, you've worked for 30 or 40 years, you're in your 60s, there's some money there. So when you are getting older and sicker and frailer, you have something to protect you against destitution. That's part of the modern social contract.
And right, just real
food
quickly,
stamps, you could argue, are another part of it, that they're so embedded now in our understanding of the social arrangements that we now think part of the social contract is an obligation to stop poor Americans falling into malnutrition and starvation. And social contract changes over time, and political philosophers have debated it for millennia. You can go all the way back to Pericles a couple thousand years ago in Athens, and there are conversations about what that obligation means. So there's nothing new about a discussion of what the social contract is. But I think Moyo's point is very profound, which is that, and I write about it in my book as well, which is that no other Western industrial democracy, no other first or second world country has the level of inequality that America has. And American poverty is really a story of inequality. It's a story about where resources are allocated. It's a story about who benefits and who doesn't benefit within that social contract. And if you look at the data, the richest in America are accumulating far more wealth than the richest in any other Western democracy, and the poorest are accumulating far less wealth, far less assets than any other Western democracy. And one of the starkest numbers, which actually Robert Rice talks about in his latest movie, Inequality for All, one of the starkest numbers is that a few hundred families, I think it's 400 families in America, control the equivalent wealth of 150 million Americans at the bottom of the economy. And
yeah,
one of the things that you see on that is child poverty. So one in four, almost one in four kids in America, and it's higher in some states, lower in others, but on average, about one in four kids in America lives in poverty. If you go into cities like Detroit or New Orleans, it's about two-thirds of kids. You go into African-American communities in many cities, it's about two-thirds of kids live in poverty. Just these stunningly high poverty numbers. What that means is truncated lives, because you're talking about kids going to school hungry, you're talking about kids finding it harder to focus on education, you're talking about all of the health implications that go with poverty. So at every measure, it impacts those kids' lives, the quality of the life, the life expectancy, and so on. And I think it's an extraordinary indictment of what's been happening in the last few decades in America that we've tolerated that, that we don't think it's a national scandal, that more kids are in poverty here than in Britain, in France, in Germany, in Australia, et cetera, that you have to go all the way down the line to Romania to get equivalent poverty numbers. And I think that's what Moyers is talking about when he says the social contract is shredded when you get to numbers like that.
There's a belief not only in the inevitability of inequality, I'm sort of quoting your book, but the desirability of an oligarchy as a social structure. In other words, if you're here in Arizona, what you hear is anybody who is poor, somehow, even though we can't figure out how it is exactly, they deserve to be there. They deserve to be there. They made a mistake in life.
It's your own fault.
They had bad luck. It's your own fault. You're poor. It's your own fault. I'm not poor, and it's my virtue.
That's right.
Yeah, you hear this all over the country, and it's a thread that runs through American political narrative for centuries, and it comes from England going back several hundred years. But
well,
it's this
you.
Idea of a sort of moral blameworthiness that is associated with poverty. So if you're poor, you probably took drugs, or you probably were promiscuous, or you probably were drinking too much, or you probably did something that put yourself in that plight. And I think in a way it's a protective mechanism, because what it allows you to say is if you're not poor, well, you did something good and virtuous.
That's right.
So it allows people who have assets and who have wealth and who have social capital to say, well, I deserve it. I deserve my good fortune. It allows you to feel good about yourself. Now, it's never been a particularly helpful way of understanding poverty, not least because it doesn't lead to policy solutions. It allows you to sort of essentially say it's a medical problem. It's an individual problem. So why worry about big systemic changes? It's never been a sophisticated way of understanding poverty. It becomes even less valid and even less sophisticated and even less nuanced in the last few years with the collapses that followed from the housing collapse. So when you look at 2008, you see millions of jobs disappearing pretty much overnight. Within a few months, many, many millions of jobs went. A state like California ended up with 12% unemployment. You go into one community after another in Phoenix in Arizona, in Las Vegas in Nevada, in Stockton and Modesto and Sacramento in California, and you see entire communities wiped out by the collapse of the housing market. And again, those are people who did nothing wrong. They happened to buy at the wrong time, in the wrong place, and were unlucky enough to get trapped by the housing bust.
Well, that's it. It's true. And
you see this all over the country. People just chronically debt-ridden. Again, either because of the housing bust or because they're having to pay incredible tuition fees now for public universities that used to be funded by the state. And the state rolls back their obligations, and the individual acquires more risk. And I think that the more that this story becomes the norm, and the more that people all over the country either experience this kind of poverty or insecurity themselves, or know people who do, neighbors, colleagues, friends, relatives, the more that the narrative of blaming the poor for being poor becomes inadequate.
I want to stick a statistic in here. You talk about, this is the 2010 census. Most Americans, 58%, 58.5%, will spend at least 1 year below the poverty line between 25 and 75. So it's not like it's like you are telling us in your book and in your discussion this morning. It's everywhere and it's all around us. Maybe it's not you, and that's great. But 58% of us will at least dip below that poverty line. I've been there, and I may be there again. But certainly that's a lot of them. You would think that, and nearly if in a country where nearly 60% of the population is going to live below the poverty line at some time in their life, there would be a more understanding or more an embracing.
Well, I think it speaks again to our sort of sense of self-identification, that historically we've had this idea that America is this exceptional country where if you pull yourselves up by the bootstraps, you succeed. So aspirationally, we all look up. We might not all make it, but we all look up the economic ladder. But I think there's a few pieces of data that have come out in the last few years which really show the extent to which the chronic inequality and insecurity of modern American life is undermining that. So one of them is this data that you mentioned, that more than half of Americans at some point in their lives are going to spend a considerable amount of time in poverty. The other data is that for the first time since this tracking was implemented decades ago, for the first time, a majority of Americans now think their children will be economically worse off than they themselves were.
Right.
That's extraordinary, because almost definitionally, the American dream is about a sort of continual arc of prosperity. But if you look psychologically now, the expectation has gone into reverse. And it turns out there's a lot of data that backs up that psychological shift. One of the interesting bits of data is that one of the reasons conservatives justify the profound levels of inequality that exist in America is they say it provides dynamism to the economy. And Rick, you were talking earlier about the celebration of inequality. It's actually a quote from Rick Santorum, who was a presidential candidate for the Republican primaries in 2012. And he went to Detroit. And Detroit's a city which has been obliterated by economic collapse over the last few decades. And he went to Detroit and he made this sort of soaring speech about the virtues of inequality because it generates opportunity. But it actually turns out, when you look at the data, that America is now more socially immobile than almost any other, again, first world economy, including Scandinavian economies. And that's important because Scandinavia has far less inequality than America, and it's got a far better social safety net. And oftentimes conservatives sort of mock the models that are in place in Sweden and Norway and so on.
Sure.
And they say, well, you know, it results in high taxation, it's sort of pseudo-communist. Well, it actually turns out what it results in is economic dynamism, that if you're born poor in those countries, you're far less likely to die poor. You've got a pretty good chance of making your way out of poverty with assistance from the state. In America, if you look at the data, if you were born poor, you're far more likely to stay poor throughout your life. That mobility is no longer there that used to define American exceptionalism. And so when the majority of Americans now say they think their kids will be economically worse off, they're actually responding to some pretty disturbing trends, which is that as inequality has been allowed to take off in America, It's resulting not in economic dynamism. It's resulting in stagnation for a large part of the population and declining wages, not just for people right at the bottom, but for the bottom 20 to 40% of Americans, that in real terms, people at the bottom of the economy are far worse off and far less secure in 2013 than they were a half century ago.
And I think conservatives think that having a vast number of unemployed people and having a vast number of people in poverty, don't they view that as a positive thing? You're talking about the dynamism. Don't they view that as a good? It motivates people.
I don't know how conscious it is. I would imagine if you talk to a conservative politician about this, if they came onto your show and you asked them that question, you know, the answer would be, of course, we don't want large numbers of people in poverty and out of work. And I'm sure that they're sincere in their own way. The problem is they're buying into an ideology that almost guarantees that a large part of the population will be economically insecure. One of the things they've bought into is this notion that trade unions are always a bad idea. Well, trade unions can be bad, just like any other institution can be bad, but they perform a vital role in a modern economy because what they do is they counterbalance very, very powerful corporate interests. So if you're a major corporation like Walmart, you have no problem buying lobbying access to Congress to say, for example, let's keep the minimum wage down or let's keep right-to-work laws in place at a state level. And the reason Walmart spends so much money doing that is they know that those kind of laws increase the profitability of a large company like Walmart. Now, if you're dealing with individual employees with no organization, it's extremely hard for those individuals to organize effectively to increase their wages, to increase access to health benefits, and so on. If you have a large number of people in a trade union, that union can bargain collectively. Walmart knows that, which is why every time workers try and unionize, for example, anywhere where there's a Walmart, Walmart clamps down. They either shut down the Walmart or they shut down the unit within Walmart that's trying to organize, but they don't let the unionization take root. You see the same thing in fast food industries. There's been a whole bunch of labor organizing in recent months, a whole bunch of very high-profile attempts to organize in McDonald's and other places. The reason for that is if you can organize, you can take wages above the floor that they're on, the $8 or whatever it is per hour floor. You can raise them up to a living wage. And so I think that saying conservatives deliberately want to inculcate poverty is probably a little bit too conspiratorial, but they're buying into a set of policies. They're buying into an ideological package that historically has always generated insecurity. And so I think, you know, part of what I was doing in my book was trying to say, look, let's get beyond these abstract ideological constructs. Let's look at the lives of the individuals caught in these insecurity traps, caught in these poverty traps. So I talked to people. One of the people I talked to was a woman called Mary Vasquez, 67 years old. She's working at a Walmart just outside Dallas. She's working for a horribly low wage. She showed me her paychecks, and she's getting less than $2,000 a month before taxes. She's too sick to take public transport to work. She doesn't know how to drive, so she ends up paying her neighbor's gas money to drive her to work. At the end of the day, she doesn't have enough money left over for food. So she's 67, she's diabetic, she's a cancer sufferer, she's eating 88 cents TV dinners, or she's going to bed hungry. That's the face of modern poverty. Another example, I met a young woman in Albuquerque. Her husband had gotten a $1 an hour pay raise from his job, and that was enough to kick the family off of public assistance. They were now too affluent. Now, one of the problems with that is they no longer qualified for Medicaid. They were living in California at the time. They no longer qualified for Medicaid. She gets sick. They end up with nearly $100,000 worth of medical bills, and the family has to declare bankruptcy. Now, when you hear one story after another like this, and I talk about them in detail in the book because I wanted to humanize these individuals, when you get to that sort of level of just daily insecurity and the daily tragedy of American poverty, it seems to me that it's much, much harder to accept the kind of ideological constructs that conservatives have bought into in recent years, that you can only accept those if you're talking in the abstract, that you can only accept them if, to a degree, you're turning your eyes and you're pretending that you don't see what's going on around you. But as soon as you do see, and as soon as you get a sense of the real impacts on real individuals of the kind of economic changes that have gone on in the last few decades in America, well, then you've got a new conversation. And it seems to me once that conversation starts, that's a way into a much more sensible discussion about changes that ought and need to be made in the economy, and in the political processes so that these 50 million Americans in poverty become visible once again.
We're talking to Sasha Abramsky, and we're talking about his book, The American Way of Poverty, with the subtitle, How the Other Half Still Lives. I have to admit, I did say at the intro that we would talk about the word still. And obviously you thought about it before you put it in there. What are you trying to say with
still?
Well,
it's actually a play on the title of a book that came out about a century ago. And it was a book, a photography book by a man called Jacob Riis. And Jacob Riis was looking, he lived in New York, and he was looking at the poverty in the tenements that immigrant New Yorkers were living in at the turn of the 20th century. And he realized that there was this extraordinary untold story, that there were people who were coming to America and working 80 hours, maybe even 100 hours a week. They were living in tenements, maybe 8 to 10 people to a room. They had one toilet between maybe 30 or 40 families. They were living in areas that were just absolute breeding grounds for diseases like tuberculosis and diphtheria and so on. And he wanted to make visible these stories. And so he publishes this book, and it's called How the Other Half Lives. And it became a national sensation.
I see.
Because what he was saying is, look, we have this narrative of, you know, the American dream, or it wasn't called the American dream back at the turn of the 20th century, but this narrative of possibility. And it's true up to a point, but an awful lot of people get hurt in that process. And it was actually that book that helped contribute to the reforms of the progressive era, some of the early labor reforms, some of the early housing reforms in big cities and so on. And so my subtitle is very much a play on that, which is that 100 years later,
they're still living in poverty.
They're still living in those conditions to a large extent. And let's look at what that means for the lives of 21st century Americans caught in those conditions.
I want to define for our listeners, first of all, we are talking to Sasha Abramsky, author of this book on poverty. But poverty, at least, there's lots and lots and lots of measurements. But for a family of four in the U.S., it's $23,000. I think for a single person, they're talking $12,000 or $13,000. Below that line, it's poverty, and and in Arizona, like I said, we're talking 1/5 of people live below the poverty lines that the government has established. And that's of all people. Only one state is lower than that, and that's Mississippi. We have our the national figures are is approaching 43.6 million, just at 14%. So the poverty rate in Arizona is around 20%. Nationally, it's 14%. Once again, a statistic that Arizona is ahead nationally, but not one that we want to be necessarily. But yeah, you trace the roots of poverty, and there's a lot of talk currently about the 1%. Certainly we had Occupy Wall Street, we had Occupy Sedona, we did our own little demonstrations in the Verde Valley here, and some of our listeners participated in that, simply because of that the stark statistics, that the huge inequality and what it causes. And one of the great things that you do is you track this poverty, this persistent and this punishing poverty, to the inequality levels. Is there any way, I mean, short of, now I have to admit, I'm a big fan of the Robin Hood tax, and we're going to talk about, we're going to do a whole show on the Robin Hood tax, or what they call the Robin Hood tax, and with the financial transaction tax. I would love to hear if you have anything to say about that, and or this inequality. How can we fix that?
Well, I think let's talk about the inequality first, because it seems to me that that's the conversation that can sort of segue into all the other discussions about solutions.
Right.
When I was writing my book, one of my sources was, I mean, I talked to hundreds of people around the country who were in poverty, but I also talked to many people who were thinkers, people who worked with think tanks, universities, and so on, and were really, really studying the causes and implications of what was happening. One of the men I talked to was Marshall Ganz. He's a lecturer at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and he's been in the world of community organizing for about half a century at this point. And he said to me, Sasha, if you think of poverty as the primary problem here, you're missing the point. Poverty is a symptom of other problems. It's the miner's canary. And the miner's canary, in the olden days, miners didn't have gas monitoring equipment. So they go down into the mines, and they take with them a bird, a canary bird. And the birds are particularly sensitive to gas. So if there's any whiff of gas, the bird's going to drop dead pretty quickly. And if your canary drops dead, you run out of the mine. You skedaddle. You go as far as you can from that dead bird because it means there's gas present. And what Gans is saying is that poverty is an advanced sign of something seriously awry, seriously wrong with the broader economy. And what's gone wrong with the broader economy in the last 40 years is this slide towards levels of inequality that we haven't seen in four generations. The last time there was anything approaching the income inequalities of today was in 1928. And 1928 led to the economic collapse. 1929, the stock market goes down. Then you have this decade of depression. You see this again in 2008. Inequality peaks in 08, and you see this collapsing economy as a result. Now, inequality is still profoundly high. What you saw in the Great Depression was a series of policy reforms around taxation, around the creation of Social Security, and so on, that limited inequality. And after World War II, the limitations of inequality get even deeper. So you have what's called the Great Compression, where for about three decades, inequality goes down. And one of the results of that is the middle classes thrive. The number of people who can access middle class aspirations, go to university, buy a home, and so on, goes up. And America enters its most productive decade. So as inequality goes down, productivity and economic growth go up. What we've seen in recent decades is inequality has been allowed to flourish again. The tax codes have been rewritten so that the wealthier you are, the smaller percentages of taxes you pay. Corporations have written all kinds of loopholes into the tax code, and inequality has been allowed to soar. So there are CEOs now getting paid 1,000 times what their workers are paid. Well, the consequences are horrific, because as inequality increases, access to the political system decreases. So the poorer you are, the less access you have to the political classes. The richer you are, the more you can buy access. And this was true even before Citizens United, the Supreme Court ruling that essentially gave unlimited free rein for corporations and wealthy individuals to buy access to politicians. Even before then, you were seeing this. But I think that this is a key part of the conversation, that increasingly our political classes, perhaps more so the Republican Party, but I'd argue to a degree both parties, increasingly the political classes tend to ignore the poorest of the poor.
You mentioned in your book that during the television debates, there's almost no mention of poverty whatsoever, either
absolutely.
As a symptom
it's
or...
absolutely extraordinary. In 2012,
right,
when millions, tens of millions of American families were living in poverty, the closest we came to a presidential-level discussion of poverty during the campaign was when Mitt Romney made this incredibly tone-deaf comment about 47% of Americans paying no income taxes and thus being essentially moochers on the federal government. And that did lead to a sort of degree of outrage and a degree of empathic conversation about, well, you know, what does it mean to be struggling? But it didn't result in serious policy discussion about how do we get out of this? And this sort of segues to the second part of your question, which is that there are a ton of ways that we could rethink the way we raise revenues and the way we spend revenues and the priorities that we have at a local level, a county level, a state level, a federal level, and the relationships between the private and the public sectors. There are many, many creative ways that are being thought about and at some level or another implemented, but which aren't gaining traction federally. And one of them is this Robin Hood tax. The official name of it is the financial transaction tax, and it's been floating around for decades. And senior progressive economists like Jamie Galbraith and Dean Baker have been arguing for this for decades. And it's the idea that in an era in which computerized trades, stock and bond and other financial instruments, are traded at warp speed by computer programs explicitly designed to look for tiny, tiny financial benefits. The name of this is arbitrage, that you look for the margins where you can make maybe 0.01 cent or something on each trade, but you trade so much that it accumulates money. If you had a minuscule tax on this, maybe 0.25% or 1%, you can pick the numbers, and there are different numbers floating out there. But because so many of these trades are taking place, a very, very small tax would generate a very, very large amount of revenue without hindering the workings of the broader economy. It would be a way to generate tens or even hundreds of billions of dollars, and that money could be invested in public infrastructure.
Yeah,
And when I say public infrastructure, I'm including in that anti-poverty programs or anti-inequality programs. So that's one of several ideas that's out there. You could also find ways, and I talk about this in the book, to create social insurance mechanisms to better fund higher education, because we all know it's a social good. Higher education generates a better trained workforce, generates economic growth. But we're putting an increasing amount of the burden of higher education on individuals. So why not find ways, like we do with Social Security, to create social insurance mechanisms for education? We could do the same for unemployment. Many countries in the world have public works funds available in reserve so that in the event of an employment emergency, like we saw in 2008-09, you can immediately liberate large amounts of money to keep people employed. Well, we didn't do that in this country, and one of the consequences was tens of millions of Americans ended up in destitution. And in states like California, one in eight workers ended up unemployed. So there are many ways that we could reform the way that we as a society calibrate our economy. And there are many ways we could do it that would profoundly impact the lives of people at the bottom of the economy. That we're not doing it is nothing to do with a lack of resources. It's to do with a lack of political will around this issue. And that's something that I think has to be highlighted, that if you can find a way to create political momentum for these reforms, America has the resources to implement them.
I think what's not clear to people is that when some unemployment happens to their neighbor, that hurts them. It reduces the whole economy. And when you have lots of people out of work who stop spending money in the grocery stores as much, or the hardware stores, or anywhere else, it accumulates. It takes the economy down. So I think people, and particularly in Arizona, a lot of people don't understand how the social safety net works. It really prevents a very, very much deeper recession and depression.
I mean, and Sasha will agree with us, a constant manipulation. We haven't talked about the media yet, but there's a constant manipulation. In other words, people on pensions are right now, Social Security, government pensions, cops, firemen, teachers, are drivers of the economy since so many other incomes have been damaged.
Yep.
And of course, corporations are now attacking those people that are living, that are these little employment centers. The guy comes and maybe you spend $35 a week to get somebody to clean your house. You have somebody that's doing your weeds. You have somebody that comes and repairs your washing machine. These pension getters are drivers of the economy, and they want to take away those pensions because they've created this sort of media jealousy that this fireman that risked his life for 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's bait and switch that, you know, the reason that economies are out of whack is that less revenue is coming in than needs to be brought in. And at least in part, that's because over the last few decades, the amount of taxes paid by the people at the top of the economy has gone down. So if you look at where the top tax rates were for millionaires under Eisenhower was a fairly conservative Republican president, or under Nixon, again, a fairly conservative Republican president, the top tax rates in this country were far in excess of 50%. In some cases, they went up to 70%. At some moments, under Eisenhower, for example, they were upwards of 90%. And one of the effects of that was that money was redistributed downwards. And that was important because you're absolutely right. Public sector pensions, for example, keep elderly people with money to spend in the community. They keep that money circulating. So local businesses, local grocery stores, local convenience stores, all of those businesses have income coming in. And it was a very effective way of growing the middle class, that you redistributed money down from the top of the economy, and the middle classes grew as a result. Now, since the Reagan period especially, the top tax rates have gone down and down and down. And the tax obligations, not just of individuals, but of corporations, have gone down and down and down. We had some conversation about this in the 2012 election when it turned out that Mitt Romney, with all of his fortune, was paying capital gains taxes that worked out to under 14% per year. Far lower percentage than most middle-class or working-class Americans can be paying in taxes. And one of the consequences of that is that we end up with too little revenue to fund things like public pension systems. But if we're not going to be able to fund the public pension systems, then we have to find a way of blaming people for the crisis. And one of the things that's happened is, you're absolutely right, increasingly we blame the recipients of pensions for the broader plight of the economy. And it's incredibly unfair, first of all, because a pension is a promise. So if you promise somebody a pension, you're essentially promising them a part of their revenue stream. You can't really back out on that promise midway through.
But they do, Sasha. They do.
Well, I know they do. And you know, to me, that's a scandal.
If
a city or a state promises something to its public pension recipients and then backs out,
it's not just public. It's also Social Security. There's a billionaire. I think his name is. I don't want to mispronounce his last name, but I think it's Druckenmiller, who's going around to speaking at colleges, telling young people that the old people are ripping them off and trying to start a war over Social Security, and going around and telling everybody that the solution is to cut the pensions of older folks. Yeah. I mean, this seems so preposterous.
It's hard to believe. Here's this
multi-billionaire going around giving advice. But anyway, it's happening. Apparently, I read an article about it recently.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is happening, and it happens even more rapidly in the private sector. I talked to men in Longview, Washington, in their 50s who'd worked at an aluminum foundry for decades, and they had a union-negotiated pension, and then this predatory investor comes in, strips the company of all the valuable assets, and then puts it into bankruptcy. And the pensions basically are thrown out the window, and all of these guys in their 50s who'd worked 30 years and were retiring suddenly had nothing but a government-backed, it's called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, and it sort of backs private pensions for pennies on the dollar. So these guys were getting pennies on the dollar of what they were promised, and their health benefits just disappeared. And you saw that, especially in the early 2000s, it involved a degree of government connivance. It was tolerated under the Bush administration in particular, where some of the biggest companies in America, some of the aluminum companies, Bethlehem Steel, American Airlines, some of these huge corporations deliberately went into bankruptcy in order to push down their pension obligations. Now, you know, to me, that's wrong.
Yeah, it's profoundly wrong,
but it speaks to a larger issue, which is that the way the economy has been functioning in the last few decades allows the rich and powerful to basically force decisions on the country that are profoundly detrimental to people at the bottom of the economy.
And here in northern Arizona, there are almost no pensions in any of the, unless you're in public sector, there's no pensions anymore.
Well,
people are going to rely on Social Security or nothing, and people are raging about cutting Social Security when the number of people, at least in Arizona, that actually have a pension has been going down. It just seems so terribly contradictory.
I think it's just, you know, deeply misguided priorities. And when you read the stories about the men and women in my book, you know, those misguided priorities, it becomes manifestly clear that they impact real people's lives. And that when you put together millions of lives adversely affected, it impacts community. It impacts our definition of what America is. You know, we have this narrative of American exceptionalism, and it's a fairly inspiring narrative. But in actual fact, when you look at American exceptionalism in the 21st century, we're exceptional for the wrong reasons. We're exceptional because we are letting poverty fester to a degree no other country does, where no other advanced economy does. We're exceptional because of the levels of child poverty we tolerate. We're exceptional because of the levels of inequality that we tolerate. All of these things are things we should not be proud of. They're things that should be addressed politically, but they're not being addressed. And I think that's one of the sort of great challenges of the American 21st century is how do you reinvigorate these conversations and how do you really put a spotlight on the fact that one in six Americans has essentially fallen outside of the American dream.
What would be your most important takeaways from this study? What did you learn from doing the book that you didn't know beforehand about poverty?
Well, I mean, very quickly, I think the complexity of poverty, the fact you can't reduce it to stereotypes, you can't say it only exists among one group or one area geographically, the fact that it is triggered by so many different things and usually so many different things coming together, so access to housing or healthcare or access to living wages. And I think that, in a sense, it humbled me because the more I interviewed people, the more I realized that this was something that, you know, it was just a huge, huge story, and it was a huge story that impacted daily lives for millions of Americans so immediately. There was nothing abstract about this. This was their worlds. And being a part of that world, being allowed to tell their story, you know, for me it was a privilege to be to be trusted enough to tell those stories. But it also, I think, you know, made me very angry that as a society we'd lost our way enough to let so many people live in such needlessly squalid conditions.
I hear you have a six-year-old that has to be taken off to
you
school.
I do. You're going to have to let me go in a minute so I can get him to school.
Yeah. Whenever you have to go, I know from six-year-old, it's been a while. Yeah.
All right. We're talking.
So let's just thank you for being with us.
Yeah.
And the book, Mike, you want to?
Yeah. The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. We haven't talked about Inside Obama's Brain, another book that Sasha Obomsky has written. Maybe we'll talk about it another day with or without Sasha.
You can invite me back anytime.
Uh-huh. That's great.
Thank you for being
nice
with us. Get that 6-year-old to school.
Yeah, we're going to talk about you after you leave, though.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
thank you
but
so
good
much.
Good things, not bad things. Later.
Yeah, good things. All right.
All right. Bye. All
thank
right.
you, Sasha.
Bye, Sasha. Yeah, this whole concept of poverty in America is complex. We all have our anecdotal stories. I spent a lot of time, I drive by Catholic Charities in Cottonwood and there was a little homeless camp back there for a while. Mm. On the second floor, they open it up 3 days a week for the homeless to get showers, to make phone calls, to get a little counseling. There's plenty of places you can face to face with poverty in the Verde Valley.
I thought one of the points that we didn't get around to talking with Sasha in his book is the isolation that poverty brings.
Yes.
The personal, social, and psychological isolation. Losing your job. Some people are thrown into depression. They begin to, first they can't go anywhere. They don't have any money to do anything. They begin to cut off friends. They decided it's some fault of their own. And so forth and so on. And, I think he made a really interesting point in the book about the psychological impact for many people of losing a job, losing their place in society.
Absolutely. One of the things I want to talk about is there's a local, I'm not going to be able to give you lots of details here, but the food bank, we have a local food bank thing going on, and you might want to find out a little more about that. There's just as big a need, where they talked about think globally, act locally. There's plenty of action you can do locally regarding the local food banks, and there's one right here in Sedona. And of course, there's many people know where the one in Cottonwood is. Either one of these organizations,
and they serve several hundred people. Several hundred people. Always need fresh vegetables and meat and stuff to go along with the dry goods. Democrats of the Red Rocks has a movie October 30th, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Sedona Public Library. It's called The House I Live In. It's about mandatory sentencing. And I think it's an important film to see. When you do public policy, there's always the potential of a kind of a negative feedback. And mandatory sentencing sounded good to people decades ago, but it's right. turned out to be extremely counterproductive.
I want to talk about they're doing a medical forum at St. Andrew's Church here in Sedona on November 10th. There'll be several people from Northern Arizona Healthcare. Lots of conversation about healthcare right now because of affordable healthcare, otherwise known as Obamacare, coming into effect. Maybe if you have some Obamacare questions, you might want to go to the November 10th forum. We have just a few seconds left, Steve.
It's a program with doctors and medical administrators. I think it's a really excellent program to check in. You can get all our podcasts on vvid.org. Next week, I think we're going to have Gary LeMaster, who's one of our writers and editors. We'll be talking about hunger in America. Is there still hunger in America? Where is it and why is it? And I think we can talk about the food banks more extensively then.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.